Welcome to another episode of What a Waste of Time. I'm Jim. I'm here with my good friends Callum.
Hello.
And Nick.
Hello.
Today Callum has once again knocked it out of the park by coming up with a great idea for a podcast that none of us ever thought of. Do you want to introduce it, Callum?
Yeah, okay. So I was thinking, I was rewatching a film, which I guess we'll reveal when we get into it. I'm thinking about how this particular film, my reading of this film, had changed significantly in light of personal changes and experiences in my life, and also events that have happened on our planet since the film was released. And then also how there are lots of examples of films like this, for example, like a famous example being The Matrix, which now has a widely known to have a reading of the movie that is as an analogy for trans experiences, especially as, you know, the filmmakers are now out. Is that the phrase?
Out would apply.
Yeah, the filmmakers, you know, Lana and Lily are now out. When they made the film, they were not. And so, you know, but still many people refuse to read the film that way, which is an interesting discussion. And then I had the idea that all three of us could pick a film that our film or some other piece of media that our reading of has changed significantly since the first time we saw it, and then talk about why that is, how we saw it before, and how we saw it now.
Okay, so I'm going to have to come up with, like, how to sum up that in a snappy title when we release this.
I've not
done it yet.
Art Through Time, the story of one's relationship to the thing.
It's going to be that now.
Boom! That's my contribution.
All right, so I'm going to start the timer. And the first thing I'm going to say is that I think both me and Nick failed the homework.
Wait. Failed is a strong word. Struggled with the homework is difficult. Because, okay, Callum has the main sexy one that is the whole genesis of what we're going to talk about. So that's going to be our jumping off point for sure. Mm. I want to say is that the notion of the question of a film that you've changed your opinion of since you watched it again because of personal changes you've undergone. When me and Jim were talking about this yesterday, trying to come up with ideas of, like, what the fuck are we going to say? One of the things I hit upon which really kind of struck me was that with films that I do watch again, like, they tend to be films that I like, and generally my reading of them hasn't changed. Mm. And I go back to them because I'm like, this really resonated with me on these particular levels or whatever. And then I watch it and I'm like, I feel reaffirmed in that nature. Whereas with stuff that, like, where there'd be more fertile ground to, for example, I know the film that you're going to talk about, I watched that film once. I also, I think in the same way that you did, didn't properly get it on the level that you're going to talk about. Mm. But I haven't gone back and watched that since. Because right. I was like, this is a film that's here. You know,
anyway,
it's perfectly fine.
Let's solve the mystery right off the bat.
Yeah.
Do a reverse Christie. Let's have our jumping off point. And Callum, you, like, start the podcast with the eloquent thing you're going to say, and we'll try and compete.
Okay. The film that I picked was, and the film that made me think about this, was The Social Network, which came out in, I should have looked at least this up, 2011 or 2012. Must have been 2011, because we were still at uni, And I also, there's going to be some discussion of, like, you know, schools and privilege and stuff when I'm talking about this movie. So for the disclaimer that goes at the start, I went to boarding school, I went to an Ivy League school, and I did dressage as a kid. So I'm also white, straight, male, all the rest. So it's like, I'm not trying to play any kind of underdog in this story. I'm just trying to discuss the stuff that's there. Empathize, but I feel like going in with that disclaimer is better than someone listening to it and thinking, Jesus Christ, who does he think he is?
But you're also like, you're much cooler than that biography would have people believe.
I think complicated is what dressage makes you. Yeah. That's certainly what I am. I saw The Social Network when it came out in the cinema. I was a fan of David Fincher at the time. though I was actually skeptical about the film because it seemed like a movie about how Facebook was made at that point seemed like a weird idea. Also, it was starring Justin Timberlake. I know that my friend Jack and I, before the film came out, realised there was a game where you could ruin the logline of any film by just putting "with Justin Timberlake" at the end of that logline. For example, David Simon makes 5 seasons of TV creating a nuanced portrayal of the city of Baltimore with Justin Timberlake. but the movie, when it came out, I loved it. A lot of other people did. The movie, for those of you who haven't seen it, traces the rise of Mark Zuckerberg from when he first had the idea for Facebook at university when he was 19 through to Facebook around the period when they got their first million users. And that's when it ends,
yeah.
And they first went international. The sort of emotional through line of the movie is tracing the relationship between the two founders, Mark Zuckerberg and his friend Eduardo Severin, and how their relationship fell apart over that time. I think the first time I saw the movie, I had not been to an Ivy League school, and I think Jim would know because he was there. I was definitely one of the people who drank the Kool-Aid in terms of the idea, even though there was part of me that was like ostensibly left-wing, there was something in my head that was like that the system around Ivy League schools and that kind of privilege had some problems but basically worked, which is how I watched The Social Network, where it was like, these are some people who were difficult but brilliant, who did a very difficult thing, and, you know, they were, like, some were worse than others, they did some horrible things to each other along the way, and it's like a dark movie, but essentially, Facebook's a good thing, and aren't these places, Harvard in the case of the movie, that are full of these brilliant people, like, aren't they interesting?
Yeah.
And sometimes good. And I feel like that's a reading that a lot of people came away with.
Yes.
If you actually look up, if you try and watch The Social Network on Netflix now, it literally has the tag Tortured Genius, which I think, again...
He's not taught... Oh, because he made a lady sad at the beginning.
I know.
It's so hard for him. He created...
Exactly. So that's the... And, like, my... The best excuse I have for that reading was I was 21. I'm not saying that, like, that excuses any of it. Especially seeing as I was old... Yeah, anyway, older than him when he made the fucking website. Since then, I've bit like, first of all, just am older, depressingly. Have also been, I went to Columbia in the US to study film. And while I was very lucky to have done that, I met a lot of great people. It's done loads for my, you know, professionally for me. And I think that going on that course was the right thing for me. And I was extremely lucky to do it and would never complain about that. It did give me much more of an insight into the actual reality of what Ivy League schools are, which is why other things like The Secret History, which Jim and I have both read,
and podcasted about a little bit.
Also resonated with me. And I think that's one of the things that's interesting is, I'm trying to think of a way that I can the thing that sort of connects it for me is two things about Ivy League schools. First of all, was the school's response to students trying to form a union. Columbia is known as the left-wing Ivy, so it's meant to be the most liberal one. Right, like, as in, like, the bluntest hedge trimmer. which, again, I now understand that to be, but when you've drunk the Kool-Aid, you're like, ah, I guess it must be true. Like, you know, all these, like, amazing, like, you know, like, Barack Obama went there. Like, you know, like, the nicer Roosevelt. Like, whatever. And then once students tried to form a union, lots of universities, because there was a law passed in the US that said students could form a union. Once that law passed, once university student bodies had voted for a union, most universities did accept it. So, like, you know, they resisted it during the vote, but once it happened, NYU were like, okay, guess there's a union. Lots of the state schools. Columbia, again, despite its liberal reputation that it rides on very, very hard when recruiting students, and, you know, all the work they do around the world and all this stuff, did not do that. Columbia basically threw in loads of legal appeals constantly against the union in the hope, after Donald Trump got elected, in the hope that Trump would nominate a new Labour board and overturn the actual law that meant students could form a union at all, and therefore during that time Columbia would not have to make any concessions to students in terms of basically them being paid living wages, in terms of what the system is now, where jobs are given out with no interviews and you can pay students whatever the fuck you like because their jobs are not jobs. They are academic positions. So this response to that, I was like, well, this is clearly not a left-wing institution, this is not a liberal institution, and this is not a force for good in the world unless you approach it from a very right-wing perspective, which is clearly not the perspective of The Social Network.
Yeah.
The other thing was on a personal level. The Social Network, if you watch it with the reading that I initially did, basically rides on the idea. There are lots of lines in the movie of like, how do you stand out at a school where everyone has a perfect SAT score and stuff like that, discussions of genius.
There's that whole bit when he goes like, hey, it's Harvard, everyone's got a startup or a project or a genius idea or whatever. Let this one go, Mark Zuckerberg, it's not that cool.
Exactly. Right. And so although I actually want to talk about that scene specifically, because there's one thing about it that's pretty amazing and very, very inaccurate. Or like inaccurate to my experience. The system for teaching assistants in the US is the lecturer teaches the big class and then tutorials are taught by postgraduate students. Oh. I taught tutorials to undergraduate Ivy Leaguers who would basically have the perfect SAT scores and all this stuff that the characters in The Social Network do. Believe me, they ain't bloody geniuses. I was confronted with kids who barely knew how to format an essay in a way that I think most of us were taught at GCSE level. Mm. As in, like, intro for against conclusion. Mm. Rampant grade inflation. If you gave a kid below a B, their parents would complain and you were reprimanded as a teaching assistant. I'd say that...
As an academic administrator, I'm like, okay, no, yeah, not how
exactly.
That's
what? Generally, generally it worked that about 10% of the kids were genuinely brilliant, and then the rest of them were just staggeringly mediocre, and I'd say about 40% were truly like, why the fuck are they here? Mm-hmm. And the explanation is the kids that get into Ivy League schools, and like, again, wish I'd done the research more, but like, it is well documented. Google like Ivy League admissions procedures for 5 seconds, and you'll be bombarded by stuff from mainstream outlets about this. Most kids are basically handed over to private tutors who will drill you on how to pass your SATs and how to pass the individual non-standardized admissions exams for Ivy League schools. Therefore, if you are at Harvard, if you are at Yale, if you are at Columbia, you are very good at passing SATs and passing those tests.
Which are not an accurate measure of intelligence or brilliance.
In the slightest.
Gotcha.
So that made me reluctant to watch The Social Network coming out of that experience that disillusioned me a lot. Because I just thought, like, well, these schools are kind of a scam, and I feel like people are buying into it. I had a really weird experience where I was reading The Secret History on a plane, and a girl about my age turned next to me and said, I love that book. I said, oh, me too. And she said, it's the book that made me really want to go to a liberal arts college. And I was like, wait, what? I was like, this is a book about murder!
You want to be part of the group of the elite kids who suck each other off about how they had a transcendent experience where they got close to some sort of Greek god that they now think exists, and in that drug-fueled bender, they killed a man?
Yeah, exactly. And so it's just like, it's amazing how, like...
I mean, I've had worse weekends.
But, you know, it's amazing how the brand of those schools, like... And the reason I'm saying this, I'm not saying this to be superior, like, it was exactly the same with me. And I wish there is some kind of... And I feel like lots of people have, like, the maturity and the self-knowledge to just know this from the out. But there are a lot of people who buy into this brand. And so it made me reluctant to watch The Social Network because I thought, like, well, it seems like the movie's kind of like that girl on the plane. And then I watched it again out of curiosity just because I like David Fincher and I like his stuff, and I started watching it and I was basically like, oh, the movie is satire. I do feel like, because the movie's made by Aaron Sorkin and David Fincher, and I feel like their collaboration and that period in Aaron Sorkin's career is interesting because I think that to say that Aaron Sorkin doesn't have some completely arbitrary and unearned admiration for Ivy League schools would be you'd be ignoring a lot. Like, every character in the West Wing sort of loudly announces what 7 schools they went to and what SAT scores they got when they walked into the room. Maybe Aaron Sorkin's really insecure about his musical theatre degree. I don't fucking know.
It's okay, Aaron. I've got one too.
Right, but like, you know, it's exactly like, you know, and then it's, and so that is weird, but I do think, you know, he made The Social Network a lot later than The West Wing. And also it's got David Fincher, who has much more of a cynical eye for these things. Hmm. And it's sort of, there are scenes that made me realise, watching the movie again, first of all, this is a satire of kids at Ivy League schools. Like, the fact that the movie opens with an incredibly obnoxious, difficult kid just being told by his girlfriend, like, you're gonna think that people have been to you because you're a nerd. It's not. It's because you're an asshole.
Yeah.
And the first time I saw that scene, I was just... It doesn't register, even though she looks the camera in the eye and says...
Hey, you!
Yeah, it's just like, don't do that! Like, that's basically what the first scene is saying. Like, this is not the good guy. There's that level. There's a scene which really sticks with me where... Which is... And again, like, the movie's coding a lot of stuff, which in fairness, maybe it doesn't do well enough, because I certainly didn't get this the first time around. I don't know if you remember, there's a scene where they're at the Hawaiian-themed frat party at the Jewish frat, which is meant to be like a crap party.
Yeah.
And it's what makes... Which also opens with a really weird conversation by Andrew Garfield having a conversation about why Asian girls love Jewish guys, which is not one I think you'd drop into a script these days.
Yes. There's a lot of weird objectification of Asian characters in The Social Network, just generally.
Yeah, like, it doesn't. Yeah, exactly. It doesn't feel like it would have, and for good reason. But later on in that scene, Mark Zuckerberg walks into the room wearing I've now forgotten the name of the school, but it's not. It's like basically, it's not Boston Latin, but it's the other American massive school.
Right.
And he comes in with that shirt on. And then, so basically the shirt that's from, like, the most expensive boarding school in America, and then proceeds to take Andrew Garfield outside and talk to him about how much of an outcast he is. And I was like, oh, it's meant to be funny. Because it's like, if there's a British film, it's like someone marching in with a T-shirt that says Eton, then being like,
listen, I know what it's like to not be from and come from anywhere real. Like, you know, I just had to work my way up.
Right.
My wits and my guile.
Yeah, and it's literally that. And it's like, why does no one appreciate us? It's so hard being on the outside, you know, act. And I was like, meant to be fucking ridiculous. They put that T-shirt on him for a reason. Like, the hoodie's like awkwardly half open. You can see it. And then later on in the movie, like, also just... So that's the first thing where I was like, okay, that's made me read this movie differently. Is that this is not meant to be a positive thing about Ivy League schools. The second thing is everything that's happened since with Facebook.
Oh, like, I don't say, yeah. Without having watched The Social Network again, like, I'm already like, given that the fundamental principle that movie kind of lands on is, isn't Mark Zuckerberg kind of sympathetic because he just wanted to get his girlfriend back? And the creation of Facebook is a morally neutral thing that, like, is just seen as, like, lots of people want to do this, and it's all fine. It's fine. Don't worry. And you look now, and you're like, oh, whoops! It feels like there should have been a last, like, you know, third of the movie where he gets way into, like, so, but what about if we just took everyone's data and basically could control everyone?
I mean, that's the thing, is that I'm like, well, because I was like, oh, wouldn't it have been interesting if the movie had been made later? But the thing is, actually, the opening of the movie just kind of does all of that. Where it's like, it's a guy... The movie was invented by a nerd who wanted to... nerd isn't even the important part. A person who wanted to compare women to farm animals on a website. Mm. And then instead was just like, let's compare girls at the school.
Face smash!
And you just like, you look at that and you're like, oh, basically the movie now seems to be putting a point of view forward. And it's like a nuanced movie, you can read lots of ways, obviously, as this podcast is about, but it's putting forward the point of view that's like, these are the worst people in the world to invent the new telephone. Like, all of them. It's like, this is the genesis of this. And if you watch that face mash scene now, you just think, of course the 2016 election came out of this guy.
Mm.
Like, this is a guy who invented it to, like, crudely compare women, and then, like, he got Donald Trump elected. Like, of course it's the logical end point.
Well, it's interesting, I think, based on my memory of the film, how the hacking sequence is framed. Because, like, in a weird thing, which I'm not... It's about people that I actually work with. There was a thing that happened recently at work, which I'll be very vague about. None of them listen to this podcast, but, you know, protect the innocent and all that. At my workplace, they have a folder where people put their, like, staff profile pictures, which go on, like, the website and whatever.
Mm.
And one person... We have, like, a workplace chat thing. Mm. And you know, we had like a private chat, which is just like our team and stuff like that. We were all working together. And someone in the team decided to go into those files and just start taking pictures of other members of staff and just posting them into the team chat. And we were like, what the fuck are you doing? That's really weird and invasive to also do that in a chat where they're not present. Mm. And just like presenting these pictures and just going, haha. And the way that the movie frames Mark Zuckerberg doing a much more invasive version of that, of literally breaking into systems and hacking in to steal these pictures for the sole purpose of publicizing them without permission, it kind of skates over the really fucked ethical stuff. And like you say, you can see how Facebook got as weird and unpleasant and invasive as it now has done. Which, I don't necessarily think that the film touches on that enough, partly because they didn't know at that point that it was going to go the way that it did. But also, like, it's a very weird thing to look at now, right?
But interestingly, the scene, because I was thinking that when I was watching it, and I was like, are we going over this? But the framing both of it simultaneously with, and again, how people watch this and think, like, the movie is framing Ivy League kids as geniuses. The Phoenix Club, which is meant to be super exclusive that he wants to get into, it's all, like, backward baseball caps, like, idiot bros.
Frat
they're like
dudes in blazers and shit.
And, like, you know, getting girls to strip on the table and all that stuff. So framing that with Mark Zuckerberg's website, it's clearly being like, this is gross, this is gross, this is gross, this is gross, this is invasive. The other thing it does is, there's then the scene where he gets put in front of the Harvard Tribunal, like, or whatever it's called, the, like, they're in, within university disciplinary system.
Yeah.
And she's like, you are guilty of breach of privacy, like abusing other people's data, and you're like, oh, the things he would do for the entire world in the next decade.
For the rest of his career.
Right. And so it's like, again, I don't know how knowing that was, but watching it now, it takes on the thing of like, she's basically listing all the things he would do wrong, and then he's like, what's wrong with that? Which part? And it's just like, it's a horrible scene to watch, because you just think, oh, we could have stopped this right there in this room. And that poor, like, academic officer was really trying. And, you know, instead we all just decided to make this guy in charge of everything.
God, being an AO at an Ivy League school must suck. Like, I've been an academic officer at, you know, not nearly as prestigious schools, but some students are really fucking irritating.
As someone who worked in an admin at one of those offices, trust me, it does.
Oh, just exhausting.
Yeah, and so the... but also, this, actually jumping back to the scene where, because it's actually the Winklevosses if you've seen the movie, the twin rowers who believe that Mark Zuckerberg stole their idea, looking back, like, he kind of did. Like, they couldn't have made it on their own, but the fundamental idea for Facebook, that was their idea, and he nicked it.
Yeah.
They went to, I don't know if they did this in real life, but in the movie they go to the head of the university through a connection of their father's. And they basically are like, please give him detention.
Yeah.
And like, that will stop Facebook existing. And the head of the university basically says, like, how did you get this meeting? And then his secretary says, through a connection to their fathers. And he says, you two being here is wrong. And that's the point where I'm like, what? That would never happen at an Ivy League school. It's like, that is considered completely valid currency.
Yeah.
It's like, they run on nepotism. They love it. There's a phrase that bounces around at Columbia, which is called, we know who the good ones are.
Oh.
Which I've had said to him in private, people have said to me in private, and that's what that is. If that meeting happened, the conversation would not have been, you've used your father's connections here and that's wrong. The conversation would have been, boys, I'm going to tell you like it is. I've known your father for a long time, and he'd say the same as me. And then the conversation follows on from that, which is like, be fucking realistic.
Yeah.
Everyone here is inventing something. That's the best case scenario. The worst case scenario is like, we'd love to, but we can't go after him because of procedural XYZ reasons. But trust me, we're going to try our best.
Yeah.
Which I imagine is what happened.
Probably,
which is where the university tried to help them, but they couldn't because, like, at that point, Mark Zuckerberg had money and better lawyers or whatever.
Mm.
I feel like the movie, and the movie does, however, let him off the hook at various points where I'm just like, oh, really? Like, later on in the movie, again, like, the sexism gets worse, but they put a lot of it on Justin Timberlake's character, the founder of Napster,
yeah.
Where it's like, he is really, really gross in his, like, creepiness with kind of, like, you know, very young women who
Let's
are working
do cocaine
at the company.
Off the belly of a 16-year-old girl.
Yeah, and it's, like, all of that. Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's like the scene where Eduardo sort of, like, there are two girls in the room and Eduardo says repeatedly to him, like, how old are they? How old are they?
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know how much the movie at times distances Mark Zuckerberg from those actions. And I'm like, well, even if Mark Zuckerberg didn't do that stuff, which he may well have done, he definitely built a website that supports that culture.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then the other thing is that at the end of the movie, there's a scene where the lawyer says to him, "You're not an asshole. You're just trying so hard to be one." Which I'd reframe that, and I'd say, like, no, he is. Like, he just is. Like, he is so past that point. The thing I would give the movie credit for is, in summing up, like, toxic masculinity among very young men, that line actually captures something pretty well.
Yeah.
I just feel like, direct to the character of Mark Zuckerberg, it's like, no, he's a piece of shit. Like, direct that at his, like, friend who got, you know, some intern who works there, maybe. Yeah. But not him. Like, I'm not saying that doesn't make him an interesting character, it doesn't make the movie bad, but it just kind of misses the mark. But again, I do think that's...
Misses the mark.
Oh! Very good.
Zuckerberg.
cool.
So yeah, that was... Yeah.
That was your spurring of where how we came to be here.
Yeah. So you gave us this homework assignment, and we were like, we failed the book report. Just because we're so good at film analysis, we nailed it first time, every time.
This was one of the reasons that I picked this. I felt like on some of the other podcasts, we'd have been a bit like, we get things and people don't. And I thought maybe...
It's a chance for us to be humble and show some humility. When you were wrong, Callum.
My ego
has no limits.
What I did do, I did put together a list of things where my reading has changed. Not perhaps to the same extent... That brilliant example of The Social Network has, but so I definitely have things I can talk about here. But I think perhaps the most valuable thing I can add is how over the past decade, as I've gone through the stages of coming out as a gay man, how that has changed my perspective of representing queerness and homosexuality in media. Particularly in my own, the way I write it. Dumbledore is sort of the perfect example. Because there's a lot of characters like Dumbledore before a certain point, where I used to call them ninja gays, where they're, like, present but invisible.
You'd never know it if the author didn't say it after everything had come out and there was no impact on sales.
It's not fair to say that you would never know it. It's the reading is there.
Yes.
More like Dumbledore, it's kind of there. Like, if you're looking at it through a queer lens, you can see it. Like, that his relationship with Grindelwald could be interpreted in that way.
Caleb, are you going to say it or am I? Because I can feel it in my mind of, you know... One of us is going to say at some point.
Jim, I think you'll find they were more than brothers.
Other examples are Hooded Justice and the other one in Watchmen. That's a bit more explicit, but it is still implied.
Yeah.
There is a line where it's like a character alludes to it to, as a sort of threat, saying like, "Oh, I know what you're really like."
Yeah,
a
comedian says it when he's getting the shit kicked out of him.
Yeah. And so that's so growing up. That's the only real like type of like gay character I would see in the type of things I liked to read and watch, and that just unconsciously, you know, affects you, and for ages, that is, like, I wrote gay characters like that. They would be present, but, if only they were president, they would be present, but invisible, because I'd just been told, not in as many words, that nobody would want to read this. And it's only, like, now, like, going forward that, partly because media has done this at the same time, that it's sort of changed in that representation is more valued now, but also in like trying to expunge the internalized homophobia that has gotten a grip on me without my realizing, that I realized like, fuck that, I'm gonna write all the gays. That's like realizing that like now my perspective on JK Rowling, there's lots to talk about with J.K. Rowling, but specifically about Dumbledore, I'm now like, 'cause
I think I used to be, like, when she first announced it was gay, I thought it was great, even though I had to, like, fend off friends' opinions, being like, oh, that puts a whole new perspective on him, like, inviting these young children into his office, doesn't it? I was like, no, because... Like,
I remember hearing jokes about that.
Yeah.
I actually, you know, if I'm laying cards on the table, I think young Nick may have made jokes like that.
And, but that's, I don't blame you for that, because... The way the culture works is that it's like it gets into you without you realizing, and if everyone sort of tacitly agrees the same thing, then yeah, like it's harder to challenge that, even if you are a gay man who is the target of that culture.
Yeah. Well, by the logic of that joke, we all thought that he was fucking Hermione before, exactly. Which is exactly. So much better.
But she's a Wom, Callum. That's what Woms are for. No, it's okay to think sexy thoughts about Wom.
Kiddie Wom.
He wasn't fucking Hermione. No, he just had a countdown timer to the exact minute she would come of age.
I hate you, internet. I hate you.
But yeah, so now looking back at that, I'm... my opinion... Like, I don't begrudge... J.K. Rowling for making the decision to include a gay character but not make it explicit, because I do believe that she did intend that at the time, and it's not a retcon as some people suggest, because that reading is there.
I would also strongly agree with that.
Yeah, like, I do think, especially because the way she tells it, the first time she told anyone was actually on a note on one of the scripts for I think Half-Blood Prince, where Dumbledore was going to make allude to a woman he fancied in the past, and she wrote the note for Steve Clovis. Steve, Dumbledore is gay. Shoved the script back at him, and he goes, "Oh." There was this sort of hubbub when she like revealed it to the world, but it's not apparent. Like from the way she tells it, that was not the first time that piece of information like became relevant.
Yeah.
However, so I don't begrudge her for feeling the need to make that decision, because I have felt the need to make that decision.
Mm.
However, my view on it now is it's still a wasted opportunity.
Mm.
Like,
especially in the current crop of movies where it's
Now, absolutely. Yeah, so, I mean, I've said this about Good Omens as well, in the recent TV adaptation, which was very good, and I enjoyed it a lot. However, the one thing I was quite disappointed by is that the book, like... You can like the queer reading of the relationship between Crowley and Aziraphale is absolutely there, to the point where Neil Gaiman acknowledges it's there.
Yeah.
And so my hope was in this retelling of it now is that they would make it explicit, and it didn't.
Mm.
And on the one hand, you know, you can there's an argument about. Well, there's an argument I have no respect for, which is, you know, loyalty to the source material, because I that's just assuming that the source material is always gospel. And
well, and also, like, the Good Omens adaptation takes some pretty liberal steps with the source material itself. You're like, well, that doesn't really hold water at all.
Yeah.
It's like they change quite a lot of things.
But also, I argued with another queer person who was saying, like, well, like that they enjoyed that it didn't need to be said. That it was because it was absolutely there, sort of. It is kind of undeniably there, with the exception of the fact that nobody says it.
Mm.
But which means people will and still deny it's there. So I can't call it undeniably there. But it's like I can see there is an argument for like the benefit of subtlety in that regard. But my like feeling on that is no, in this retelling. In telling it in this time, it is sorely needed to make that explicit.
Mm.
Because for too long, queer characters have been erased. Even if, like, oh, all the other trappings are there. The fact that we... first of all, the fact that we don't say it is bad enough, because why can't we say it? Second of all, there's a scene where... that Crowley and Aziraphale are having an argument about how to deal with Armageddon, and Crowley like leaves, and a passerby on the street says comforts Aziraphale because he has interpreted this as a lover spat, and comforts Aziraphale, and the joke there is meant to be he's misunderstood, but if the homosexuality of their relationship is meant to be there, then that's not a misunderstanding.
Mm.
So why is that a joke?
With the, I mean, from the book, that specific moment, and I totally agree with your take of it, that the moment that you're referring to in the series isn't actually in the book originally. They've moved a joke from when they first encounter Anathema, and they give her a ride in the car after knocking her off her bike and all that kind of stuff. And she has this weird moment of being like, I don't know what's going on with these guys, they're clearly very suspicious, I've got into a car on a dark night, no one knows where I am. Is something bad going to happen? Then they let her out, goes away, and Crowley says, "Come on, Angel." And then the narration, she says, she goes, "Ah," she thought, "I was never actually in any danger at all." And it's like, again, it's still very much of its time kind of humor of like, oh, it's funny when we think people are gay, but they're not. But I think it works better in that because there's more of a motive reason for it because it's a named character.
But also
having a reaction to that sequence.
There's enough vagueness there that you can say, like, yes, she has misinterpreted what the word angel means, but also has she correctly identified the nature of their relationship?
Exactly. Whereas moving it to a bit part character just...
Joke, it's... anyway, I feel we're moving a bit away from the topic there, because now I'm just ranting about representation of sexuality.
Rambling on this podcast? So
to sum up my point, is this, like, as I have grown as a person, my opinion on representations of sexuality has changed. Mm. And generally now, like, I think that not enough of it is being done.
I think that the one thing I'd say to that is having had, like, an experience in filmmaking that's relevant to it is I made a film, a short film... there was a love story, but because it was about hackers and because the two people in it were incredibly awkward, I chose for that because it was a man and a woman. I chose to, at the end of the movie, not have them kiss and not make it explicit, basically because in like the amount of time they'd known each other, I didn't think that's what the characters would do. Mm. And people went fucking mad. and I think that's
like
generally...
Like in good way or bad way?
No, bad way. They were like, why aren't they kissing? I want to see them kiss. Yeah. I want to see them kiss. Why have you made... people won't get it if you don't make it explicit. You can't do that. No. And it was like... I was just like, well... And I generally think, like, if you see a movie where there's a, like, male-female romantic relationship that is everything but, people do get annoyed in that way, whether the movie should have kept it subtle or not. And I think keeping it subtle is a different thing, because obviously we've seen that relationship literally a million billion times, so it's fine to try something new with it. But I think it's then hypocritical when you have, like, the one time there's a queer relationship on screen, and people are like, no, let's leave it implied. And it's like, no, if it was the other situation, I know from experience, people would lose their minds.
Yeah.
So, like, the only reason you're saying this is because of homophobia.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. But, and especially since the way that that last episode of Good Omens spends a lot of time focusing on the heterosexual relationship of the minor characters, cutting back and forth between Shadwell and his neighbour, whose name I forget.
Madame Tracy.
Yeah, sure. Who, let's not get into the whole fact that she had to, like, in order for him to accept her, she had to stop, like, dressing provocatively. And also between... Anathema and Newton, and like how they have, even though they had very little impact on the story, there's a whole thing about how that, like, oh, we're happy together now and our new lives and what have you, and they all, well, I don't think Shadwell and I've already forgotten the name again,
Madame Tracy.
I don't think they kiss, but there's a definite moment of domesticity, and there's a line where about there is a joke about like, Shall I pop the question? Which is clearly meant to be read, you know, read in terms of marriage. But then the joke is he asks how many nipples, but there is definitely, I mean, there's a whole fucking sex scene between Anathema and Newton Pulsifer.
Which I will say again, this is one of the awkward things about the transition of the text into visual thing of that, because they do a lot of stuff with doing like kind of amusing visual cuts of like, Newton's in there. They're the witches. They'll be doing things to him. Cut back to the, oh, we're having some fucking sex in a hurricane, whatever. Whereas, and it's played more for laughs. In the book, it's all in what they refer to in the film, me and Orson Welles, as the quadruple space, where it's all like, they sank down on the bed. Quadruple space. And it's like, all the interesting stuff happens in there, but you don't actually see it. And the thing that I find quite interesting about it is in the book, that sequence is very much like they both think they're about... Well, Newton thinks they're about to die, and Anathema is both caught by the tides of destiny, but is also not 100% sure that she's not about to die. And she knows that this person is someone who she's meant to have this connection with. And it's played as a kind of weird, awkward moment of, like, comfort between the two of them in a hyper-extreme situation. And then we come back afterwards, and they're like, oh my god, we're not dead. And then the story keeps moving from there. Because they put much more focus on it, I felt like that particular character beat doesn't land in the right way. And also, I still think it's very much like we're talking about our relationship to a piece of art over time. Times have changed. Like, I think the beats of those relationships functioned better in, like, when was Good Omens written? Like, the 90s, right?
I mean, I've got it on the shirt.
Yeah.
A while ago.
It was written in, like, the 90s, where the interplay of both, you know, like, heterosexual couples is, I think, in some cases, is more nuanced now. There's less of an expectation that, which is like, oh, yes, you have male character and female character. You sort of just assume that it's going to happen. Whereas I think now we've become more used as audience consumers of seeing more complex depictions of how those relationships happen. And I think the adaptation thing for Good Omens made it worse in a way. Because, like you said, it took more attention to that specific thing and this kind of, like, not very believable, weird beat. And it's just...
And from my perspective, just like, why are we spending so much time on these characters and Crowley and Aziraphale are not even allowed to kiss?
Yeah.
That sums up my point on that.
Yeah.
Anyway, we have 20 minutes left.
Oh,
like,
I think I'm going to sort of piggyback off your kind of thing of, like, mine is less specific, though I can probably pull specific examples. But I think a thing that I've really noticed, over, I guess, like, maybe the last decade, similar kind of thing, where, like, because in, rather than coming out or whatever, I've become much more both politically aware and politically engaged. And I've also had to do, over that period, for a variety of reasons, had to go through a lot of things of, like, unpicking various unconscious biases, be they, like, my relationship with women, my relationship with queer people, my relationship with politics. Like, I have, over the last 10 years, like, grown a lot as a person, and I feel a lot more strongly about things than I did when I was, like, 18, and I was a much more passive kind of artistic consumer. I think the thing that I want to kind of use as a lightning rod point for this is that I've become much more uncomfortable with what are considered the classic dynamics of superheroism. Because I look at something like Superman, who originally was created in the 30s by a couple of Jewish creators, and he was originally taking on corrupt officials, people trying to break up unions, and he was a very sort of like man of the people type character. And over the time, when you get to the point where I started reading comics, Superman had evolved into this sort of mimetic symbol for truth, justice in the American way. And what that meant was that he would be maintaining the status quo rather than challenging it. And I think I have the same problem again with Batman. Like, I am a known critic of Batman. I don't like Batman on a conceptual level. I hate Batman. It's dumb. Fuck you, Bruce Wayne. But the thing that really annoys me is that it is a incredibly wealthy man going out and beating up criminals instead of, and diverting vast amounts of his personal fortune to crime-fighting gear, when he could be using that to actually enact social change on a massive level in the city in which he lives. And for me, that's sort of... you have stuff like in the comics now, they're like, oh, he's got the Wayne Foundation and he does so much good. And I'm like, yeah, but not so much good that there isn't still regular amounts of, like, muggers for him to swing in and beat up. It's not that they're still, like, you know, fucking...
I was also going to say, like, if you want to... Sorry to be, like, a real, like, commie bore, but, like, philanthropy is undemocratic and, like,
yeah. You
know, it's like, even if Bruce Wayne were doing that, like, the Wayne Foundation is not morally neutral or good
either. Exactly.
Like, you know, the best thing Bruce Wayne could do would be to pay his fucking taxes and just give his money away to, like, if reliable elected officials were in power, to them.
Yeah.
My friend Claire made the exact same point about Iron Man, is that it's like, oh, he's trying to, you know, assuage his white guilt, but he keeps all of his wealth that he's made by selling weapons to less developed countries.
Well, this is the thing,
exactly.
with Iron Man specifically as well, there was one that really, this was back before I was completely burnt out on Marvel. Like, in Iron Man 3, there's the whole thing, the ending of Iron Man 3 was very like, I'm getting rid of all of the suits, I'm going to stop being Iron Man. There's this metaphorical torch pass moment with that one kid who turned up at the funeral in Endgame. Everyone went, who? Oh, the kid from Iron Man 3. Right.
His name is Captain Confusing. That's the one. He shows up in scenes, you don't know who he is. Very well set up. It was a 7-film callback. It's great.
But you have the thing where he sort of like destroys all of the armors and like, you know, finally changes his ways. But because status quo is kind of king, it's really, really difficult to actually get superheroes that enact actual change.
I mean, you can't even kill them.
Yeah, because they'll just come back eventually or be recast or re-released or whatever. Like, this is why I particularly enjoyed the comic book series Invincible. Now, I want to say up front, there's a lot of readings in Invincible where you go, ooh, this has a troubling racialized aspect to certain aspects of this. Uh-oh, oh no. And also, gender politics are a bit all over the place. I'm not saying it is above reproach, but mechanically, one of the things it does really well is that because it's a self-contained superheroic universe, massive changes happen. Like, and you have the lead character, Invincible, go from being like, I want to be this idealized version of a superhero, to I've realized my entire life was a lie because of one reason or another. Now I'm working for the government. Now I've realized that the government is evil, so I'm trying to find something else to do that. Now I've realized that this one supervillain has all these really good ideas that no one's actually doing, so I'm going to join up with him. And his moral path throughout the whole thing is consistent and believable. But it's about him being more like, well, I've got capital, or like, you know, power in this scenario. What can I actually do to make lasting, meaningful change? And I think that's something that I've become much more sensitive to. That I find things where the characters defeat the bad guy and then it's assumed that everything's fine. Like, one of the great critiques of Harry Potter is, yes, they defeat Voldemort, but we all knew that the Ministry had massive problems of, like, you know, inherited wealth, systemic racism, you know, massive problems of inequality in it already, but we never really addressed that because it was more like we defeated the bad guy and then we get an epilogue where it's loosely implied that all of our characters went to work for the government, so maybe they changed it.
I've not seen
Cursed Child, but it's that kind of thing that makes me kind of really yeah.
Which is why, you know, they had to change the last book's original title. It wasn't Deathly Hallows, it was Harry Potter and the Blairite Fairy Tale.
Also, like, another problem with like, because the central conceit of Harry Potter is this sort of fantasy of you are part of a secret society, or you discover that there is a secret society that you are a part of, that exists under, that is in the world as we know it, but secretly. And that's, you know, appeals to the child in us about feeling special and but feeling like you're part of something.
Forbidden knowledge.
And all of that. But that does mean that the plot kind of has to uphold the notion of that the international statute of secrecy is necessary, when in fact the wizards could probably do a lot to help the world of muggles if they decided to involve themselves with it.
Yeah, so I think what I've kind of come down on is that the way that my relationship to pieces that I've read is that there are things that I enjoyed reading as a kid, like, you know, or even as a teenager, because, like, as I think I've said on the podcast before, I didn't really start having anything like an informed opinion, or rather, like, engaging my actual critical faculties of how to understand what work is both trying to say and trying to make me feel until I was, like, 18, 19, because I hadn't really, even though I come from, like, a very well-read family who do engage with material on those levels an awful lot, and I'd even been, like, writing and stuff, but it had always been very abstract in the sense of, like, it's just like when I have, you know, my self-insert character who's like a white blonde-haired vampire guy, like, you know, save all the ladies, I don't understand that I'm, you know, kind of, that's a bit weirdly patriarchal and sexist, isn't it, that I'm denying the female character's agency. I had not yet gotten the mental tools to be able to make that kind of connection between things I was making and the rest of the world and the experience of other people. But now, because I try my best, and, you know, Lord knows I'm not perfect at it, to retain a sense of empathy and curiosity and trying to experience things outside of my own perception, because I live in this one, it's not that interesting, to be honest, and hearing how other people experience the world and also how we can make changes and being more speculative is much more appealing to me now. And I don't know if I necessarily fall onto the side of, like, the notion of maintaining the status quo is inherently, like, pernicious or dangerous, which I think in some cases it is. Like, fucking, one of the big examples that really rubbed me up the wrong way was Captain America the Winter Soldier, which is, like, two-thirds of a really good movie. And then I feel like the last act, they kind of realize they have to pump the brakes hard on the thematic line that they've been going, because it's like, oh, the American government has actually been taken over by super Nazis since, like, forever, and everything bad was all the super Nazis doing it. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's really interesting. It's kind of a critique of the American government that no one noticed that secret super Nazis were directing foreign policy and making us get into all these wars and kill people and hyper-capitalism and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, yeah, cool, interesting. This is great that they're really, like, having this very pointed talk. And then they blow up that one computer, and the problem is never really mentioned again. And at the start of the next film, which was Age of Ultron, they're like, well, we dealt with Hydra. And you're like, okay, I understand why, but also, like, you can't dangle that, hey, big critique of, like, American foreign policy and domestic policy here. Well, and then just whip it away. That, to me, now feels really like, but...
But, I mean, like, I don't want to turn it into another thing of, like, me defending Marvel again, but I would say, like, the consequences of that was felt in other films in fairly significant ways to characters. Like, one, S.H.I.E.L.D. doesn't exist anymore. True. After that. Two. Yeah. Also, it's the motivation for everything that happens in Civil War, because
yep.
Captain America doesn't want to sign the Accords, because he's been through an experience of the government being taken over. Which was funny, because I remember when that film came out, people were like, in the real world, Iron Man is right, but in the superhero world, the government gets taken over by Nazis, so arguably Captain America has a point. And then Trump happened.
Everyone was like,
in the real world, Captain America is right. But yeah, it's that. So I feel like it does have knock-on effects later on.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not saying it's the best reading or like whatever.
I'm not saying that they don't do anything with it. I think the thing that bothered me is that, to me, that argument that they presented of like, look how kind of fucked up the American history and the American government is. And I'm like, yes, that's a thing that we can observe in the real world, which I'm like, that's a very pointed and powerful thing for a franchise like Marvel to make that point. And then they go, it was all secretly super Nazis. And I'm like, okay, yeah, okay, yes, I'm still with you, because I'm like, you don't want to be too critical of the, what is probably a large portion of your funding, I'm certain, you know, in various ways. You know, but you still want to be able to sort of make that critique. And I'm like, that's also fine. You then tear down the super Nazi regime. And I'm like, also great. But then, the problem is that there doesn't seem to be any meaningful difference in the way that the government operates that much. We're like, obviously, S.H.I.E.L.D. doesn't exist anymore, but it's still ostensibly our world, because that's part of the conceit of Marvel, is it's meant to be our world, but with a few key differences here and there. Which is part of the, which is endemic to the design of the thing, and I'm not, it's not necessarily a fair critique to be like, oh, why not? But it's a thing that I've come to be much more sensitive to. Where it's, I'm sort of like, yeah, but why didn't you make the change? You know this was the problem, and you can't say, we solved the problem, but then not actually demonstrate anything meaningfully different. That feels wrong to
me. Yeah, and I feel like basically everything in that was, those events were framed, which is not invalid, as motivations for the actions of the superheroes later on in movies, as opposed to actual change on society, where it's a movie that we've both just seen a trailer of, so not yet. But if you compare that to the way that, say, the Kingsman prequel seems to be framed in World War One, which is basically very much like, or Kingsman in general, like the way Kingsman One frames class, where it's just like, no, the system is the problem.
Yes,
the system is the thing that we are like. It's an explicit critique, and there is, in the way that, say, like, you know, Black Panther proves, like, Marvel is perfectly capable of doing that without losing buckets of money. But they didn't.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they absolutely could have gone further and harder, you know, with that, and it would have been a better movie for it.
Agreed. But yeah, so I think that's the thing that I have really, you know, based on the premise that Callum gave to us, like, how has your perception of a piece changed? So I don't know if there's a thing I could necessarily, strictly speaking, point to and be like, that one. That's the one that, like, is in quite the same way, because, as I said, I don't tend to go back to things as much in quite the same way, I think, because I know that you definitely have a very eclectic and wide palette, especially with film, because you'll watch pretty much everything.
He's talking to Callum at this point.
Yeah, sorry, I'm gesturing.
Because I am the one who will watch any old shit. Yeah.
But you'll also be more experimental, and you're the most film literate person on the podcast, I think that's fair to say.
No, I'm not going to take offense at that. Yeah,
because I'm like, not only because of the nature of your education, but also by the fact that you watch an absolute metric fuck ton of films. And you make them in a much more direct capacity than either Jim or myself.
Yeah, although just to, and I'm not, and like, thank you. I also think that like one of the great things about film is that anyone can have readings on them, and I definitely think you don't need a piece of paper for that. But like,
But because of the circumstances, of course, you tend to go back to films that you've seen before. You tend to have much more of like a, well, what is my relationship to this and how it interconnects?
Mm.
Whereas because my thing is, I think the thing I read the most of is probably comic books, right? Because I read an absolute ton of those. Like, looking back on some manga, which sometimes you just go, that wasn't fine. That wasn't okay.
But I think what is more rare, and that's perhaps a sign of the times, is to have a new reading like Callan's, where you go back on a film and you see a new layer of theming or critique that you hadn't seen before, which it does happen with aging. But what most of my examples were, it's like, oh, I used to think this was good, and now I don't, and I didn't really want to talk about that.
It is a hard line to. Because I did think about that after I suggested it. And I was like, oh, yeah, how many other examples could I think of than this one that's right in front of me?
I can definitely think of stuff where I have a greater appreciation for. Like, movies with Mikey, the YouTube channel, he does a lot of good stuff like that. Because like, a lot of video essays on YouTube are just like, this is why this thing sucks. And it's like, yeah, it does suck.
Which is fun.
Yes. But Movies with Mikey does a really good job of making you appreciate something you already liked in a new way. I found that particularly true of his video on Wonder Woman.
No, because, I was thinking of the same one.
Because I liked... I liked Wonder Woman. But when he sort of explained that, Wonder Woman is great. And even though it was met with all of this difficulty it had to overcome just to be made, and also to fit into this world that somebody else had created, and like what a hard job it had to do, and look how fucking great it is.
And this skirt that somebody else had created.
Yes.
And then they use that as a template for their entire Amazonian culture. They're like, okay, this is what we've got for Wonder Woman's outfit. They're like, okay, let's extrapolate those design elements and make sure it's thematically consistent.
Yeah, and it kind of works, and yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
And just, yeah, like, remember him just pointing out, like, yeah, it's about speaking truth to power, and it's like, oh god, yeah, that's a fucking powerful film.
Yeah, and definitely, and one of the things I fucking love about that movie is that it pointedly and emphatically says no to the notion that there's the one guy that you can beat to stop the thing. And like, you know, I love it. So I love the fucking thing where Chris Pine is, you know, where she says, I've killed the guy and no one's stopping. And you know, why are they still doing this? And he just goes, because maybe we're all shit. And I was like, that's such a daring fucking statement for a ostensibly a superhero blockbuster movie meant for like, you know, slightly older children and teenagers, to be like, maybe humans aren't intrinsically good. Maybe we will be self-destructive and fucked up, and that's why you, looking at the camera, you need to take the steps to try and not be this, because it's easy for us to all do this. And I was just like, that's great. That's so fucking out there in terms of, like, messaging, of, like, trying to get people to understand that, like, this, like, stories are stories for a reason. They are comfortable for a reason. They follow beats that aren't necessarily commensurate with real life. And I think it's really good that they're like, no, we're pushing at it.
Well, it's also like, I mean, it's the same. Also, like, Chris Pine, low-key in some of the best superhero movies.
Yeah.
Where it's like, because he's amazing in Spider-Verse as well.
He plays low-key?
No, I'm sorry. Well, anyway, who fucking knows these days? But also, like, actually, I was thinking, like, when you were saying the thing about, like, soups, I feel like one of the ways that the better superhero movies are sort of trying to re-examine this is, like, going into the idea of legacy. Like, you know, Spider-Verse does that, where it's, like, the different versions of Peter Parker. It's almost some sort of, like, superhero Christmas Carol, where it's, like, here's all the things you could be. And then also, like, Logan has the same thing of, like, acknowledging that you can't... Yeah, why aren't all superhero movies as good as the best one?
Yeah, but it's the best one! It's so good!
Because it's like, I mean, it was that movie, that's the movie that really kills Endgame being as good as it could be, because it's like, no, this is what a real ending looks like.
Yeah.
But that movie acknowledges, like, he doesn't fix everything.
No.
He just saves those kids.
He does everything, like, that he can at that time.
Yeah.
And gives everything he has to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, in a way, and it's not cool, it's not dignified, it's not fun, it's not cathartic. It's like, oh, fuck, he's killing himself.
Yeah.
He, you know, it's not like fucking, you know, and again, I'm not harping on Endgame. I think Endgame's perfectly fine. But you compare the moment where Tony Stark does the thing.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Like, he gets a pithy one-liner, he gets a cool, like, fucking dramatic, da-da-da, I'm, and you're like, oh my god, and people love it, and they go crazy for it, it's great. But you compare that to the way that Logan does literally the same thing of giving himself to save just those kids. And it's like, the tone and the feeling of it is so like, oh shit, like, he's actually... no one wants to do this. Yeah. This is a hard, difficult thing that he feels he has to. And it's like, ah, oh, Logan's so fucking good.
I mean, like that...
Ah!
I mean, like, that thing with Tony Stark is, like, on posters for the re-release. No one's putting... Spoilers for Logan, watch it. Seriously, watch it. No one's putting Hugh Jackman choking on his own blood while a tree's been stuck through him.
Yeah.
On a poster. Mm. Like, because it is, it's that... And not that, like, being grim makes it bad. Like, if you made an equally good comedy about the same issue, which Spider-Verse kind of is, I'd be all for it.
Yeah.
You know, but it's like... yeah, it's like acknowledging... Yeah, examining the legacy, and it's an interesting... It's interesting. And, like, Black Panther to an extent as well.
Yeah, like, Black Panther, again, really good. Yeah. Like, says... Wait a minute, the status quo is bullshit! And you're like, hey! Yeah.
And that's the reason I think you and I both enjoy Last Jedi as well, because... Mm. I love
The Last Jedi too.
I'm picking on it because I'm remembering a conversation we had earlier. But it's like, even in the year that's also... Two years, since Last Jedi was released, of course my reading of it has changed in response to the reaction to it, and I'm now able to appreciate a lot more of the criticisms. I'm looking back at the Laura Dern plotline. I can see, like, you know, that wasn't very strong, and I'm looking at the Canto Bight. I always thought that was a bit out of place, but I understood why it was there. But I'm still coming away from it looking, no, I love that this film made a story about A, failure, and B, dynasties don't matter. In Star Wars.
Mm.
I love that is where they went. And so, yeah, I still fucking love that movie.
It follows on from the legacy of, like, The Empire Strikes Back, which is a movie for children, which basically at the end of the movie shrugs. And he says, well, I can either do one or two things. I can do the thing you want me to do and let my friends die, but maybe save the universe, or I can save my friends, but then potentially destroy the universe. And the response of the old wise figure is, yes, life's a bitch, isn't it? You've basically got a pick.
You kind of fucked it here, Luke.
Yeah. Or yeah, it'll just not even you fucked it, like, life's going to confront you with choices like this.
Yeah.
And you just have to pick one. And then he does, and it's horrible. But if he picked the other one, it would have been horrible too.
Yeah. And he gets maimed, and he literally tries to kill himself, because he's all like, well, turns out my dad is, like, you know, Space Hitler, and I've lost a hand, and I've got no other options, and he's either going to drag me off and turn me into him, or I can just jump into the unknown and, like, try and find something different. And you're like, oh, fuck, that's daring and cool.
Yeah.
You know, but also terrifying and scary. Yeah. It's, like, not what people expected.
Yeah, yeah, Empire Strikes Back is amazing.
So that's time. This is a really good topic, Callum. I, like, still, there's a whole bunch of stuff that I was going to, like, I'll talk about this that I haven't. it's definitely, like, feelings change on things upon second viewing. We all grow as people.
I was going to say the quote, well, it's not really a quote. I heard him say it live, so I guess it is a quote. The author of The Reluctant Fundamentalist, Mohsin Hamid, said that we are all immigrants through time. Because you're always, even if you never left the place where you live, if you never went anywhere or did anything different to what you do in your routine every day, the world is still changing and your relationship to it has to evolve because everything is always changing. And I was like, that's a really good quote, Mohsin Hamid. Yay.
Yeah, he's a smart dude.
He is.
Agreed. Thanks for talking about it, everyone.
That's all right. Thanks for listening to this waste of time. What a Waste of Time featured the voices of me, Jim Woodall, Nick Hurd, and Callum Smith. Music by Anthony Bullinger.